Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Foss is a Professor of Medical Oncology and Dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed welcomes Drs. Jonathan Pachalski and Lynn Tanui for a conversation about lung cancer. Dr. Pachalski is an assistant professor of pulmonary medicine, and Dr. Tanui is a professor of pulmonary medicine.
Why don't we start off with maybe a brief overview on lung cancer? And John or Lynn, maybe one of you can kind of tell our listeners kind of what's the magnitude of the problem with respect to lung cancer.
Lung cancer is an enormous health problem in the United States and in the world. It is the leading cause of cancer death in our country and globally. And in the United States, about 160,000 people will die this year of lung cancer. It is not as common a cancer as breast or prostate, but it unfortunately does cause more death.
And I guess in terms of risk factors, we commonly associate smoking with lung cancer. Is that the only cause, or are there perhaps other causes of lung cancer as well?
There are other causes. Smoking is by far the leading cause, but lung cancer does occur in non-smokers. There can be different occupational exposures, such as asbestos, radon, not radon you see in the home, but other exposures that can cause lung cancer. So smoking is certainly the number one risk factor, but there are others.
And this incidence of secondhand exposure, so, you know, perhaps relatives or loved ones who don't smoke but are exposed to someone who's a big smoker, is that a real problem, or is that kind of more hyped up than what is reality?
Well, I think secondhand smoke or passive environmental tobacco exposure is important. Unfortunately, in this country, we've made great inroads in prevention of that. I think if you put it in perspective, the increase in risk from passive tobacco exposure is about double what it would be if you didn't have that. And you have to put that in the context of primary cigarette smoking. So somebody who's smoking themselves, the risk increases 600 plus fold. Hmm. So I think it is a real but small risk.
And I've heard it said that if we were to eliminate smoking altogether, we could pretty much eliminate the vast majority of cases of lung cancer. Is that correct?
That is true. In the United States, still more than 90% of cancers in men of the lung, and probably in excess of 80% in women, occur in smokers. But we know that 15 or more percent of lung cancers in women occur in non-smokers. And in the rest of the world, the incidence of lung cancer in non-smoking women is considerably higher, particularly in Asia. Mm-hmm. So I think if we could eliminate smoking, which would be a great thing, the majority of lung cancer would go away, but it wouldn't become zero. And I think it's important to recognize that for women in particular, if you look at the absolute number of women in the U.S. who die of lung cancer who are non-smokers, it actually exceeds the number of women who die of ovarian cancer. Mm. So it is a large number.
And Lynn, what do we know about the underlying cause of lung cancer in those Asian women? Is it a genetic component, or?
Genetics definitely seems to be a part of it. We know a lot more about molecular biology of lung cancer than we used to. Even 5 years ago, you would be an expert in things like that. In Asia, there is a very high prevalence of a particular gene in a molecule called EGFR, and that seems to predispose, those mutations seem to predispose those women to getting cancer. Those women also have different exposures. So, for instance, in many Asian countries, women still cook over open flame with different sorts of oils, and those volatilized oils have carcinogens in them. I think we're just starting to understand the why of people who don't have the most common risk factor, smoking, get lung cancer.
And John, question for you. If a person who, say, was a heavy smoker quit smoking 10, 15 years ago, does the risk factor for developing lung cancer go back to zero, or is there still kind of a residual, you know, increased risk for that individual to develop lung cancer down the road?
So it certainly decreases. People who stop smoking, for those people, it's certainly advantageous to do so because the risk drops off after about 10 or 15 years. The further and further away, the lower and lower the risk, but it's always somewhat elevated compared to a non-smoker.
And also, does the risk of lung cancer increase in, say, someone who has underlying lung disease, or does it really not matter whether or not they may have, say, bronchitis or emphysema?
You know, all of those things matter. Risk factors for lung cancer are additive. So, for instance, if you smoke and you have emphysema, the risk of the lung cancer is more than just the smoking and more than just the emphysema. There's some risks that seem to multiply each other. Asbestos and smoking seem to behave in that way. But the more your risk factors are, the higher the likelihood, unfortunately, that you will get it.
Okay. And then what are the types of symptoms that one would begin to get a little concerned that perhaps there might be a lung cancer brewing?
So there's not necessarily a specific symptom, and just because somebody has one of the symptoms that I'm going to mention certainly does not mean they have lung cancer. It can be just actually fairly common respiratory symptoms. So a person may simply have a cough. Sometimes they may notice by coughing up blood. They may feel more short of breath than usual, may have a new wheeze. These types of more common respiratory symptoms that certainly are not specific to cancer. A lot of times people are completely asymptomatic, and it may just be discovered at whatever stage.
Yeah, so the symptoms that you just mentioned really sound like the symptoms that would be associated with kind of normal pulmonary respiratory illnesses,
yeah,
and not necessarily cancer.
No, that's right. That's right.
So I think it's important to remember that we all get those symptoms, mm-hmm, but persistent cough, persistent shortness of breath, chest pain, things that I think we'd all recognize as it's not normal to, mm-hmm, have this symptom persist for weeks or months. That should trigger a call to your doctor.
Yes, I was just going to ask, so when you say persistently, especially for our listeners out, mm-hmm, there, so if the cough or shortness of breath or wheeze lasts for, would you say 1 month, 2 months, that they should go maybe seek medical attention longer than that?
I think for somebody who coughs or wheezes regularly, lots of my patients who have underlying lung disease, they would notice a change, I think, in the quality or the intensity of those symptoms. For somebody who never has those symptoms, often those are, you know, in the context of a simple respiratory infection, but they would resolve then usually within the span of a week to several weeks. Mm-hmm. And if it lasts longer than several weeks, I think, again, that's worth a call to your doctor or a visit.
And the person that they that individual should call, would it be the primary care general internist, or should they actually go ahead and seek the attention of a lung specialist like the two of you?
I think it's always important to maintain the relationship with the physician who knows them best, and certainly all physicians are well aware of it. And so I think that if there's something unusual, something that still hasn't been able to be figured out, they could easily be referred thereafter. But maintaining their communication and visits with their primary care physician are essential.
So an individual with new symptoms, persistent symptoms, goes to see their primary care physician, and then what would the process be from there?
It's easier for the patient and probably more efficient for their physician to call, because there's always a need for transfer of information, and that patient's physician is probably the person best able to put that in a context that will get the patient the appropriate care quicker. more efficiently and without the patient having to do a lot of that legwork. Mm-hmm. I think at a time when an individual may be very concerned about the possibility that there's something bad going on, like a lung cancer, that's the time their own physician can really help them most, is to make that referral easier and let the patient deal with just getting to the appointment and not worrying about transferring information.
And what types of tests would be done to try to figure out what's going on in that patient with symptoms?
Usually one of the first tests is going to be a chest x-ray, mm-hmm. To see what's going on, although other tests, depending on the circumstance, may be needed. But usually the first test is going to be a chest x-ray.
Now, just curious, so, you know, for colon cancer, we've got the colonoscopy, and for breast cancer, we have mammography, and obviously for cervical cancer, we have the pap smear. You know, is there such a screening early detection test for lung cancer?
Now, there have been lots of investigations into this, but so far, there has not been a test that's been able or that's been proven to detect lung cancer. So over the past several years, many investigators were looking at the role of CAT scans, mm-hmm. For screening, but that really did not pan out yet, and at least is recommended by the American College of Chest Physicians, ACCP. It's not recommended to routinely get a CAT scan unless one is particularly involved in a trial or something else within the medical community. But just to go out, request a CAT scan really has not been proven to be efficacious.
And I guess in that regard, then a kind of a routine chest x-ray would also not be a very reliable test for trying to pick up an early lung cancer?
There have been lots of studies actually looking at that, and you'd think that that would be the case, that having routine x-rays should pick up lots of cancers. And it turns out that's not actually true. And those studies really date back all the way from the 1970s to the present. And they don't seem to be able to decrease the mortality associated with lung cancer. And unfortunately, what chest x-rays and CT scans thus far have demonstrated is that they pick up a lot of small abnormalities, the vast majority of which are benign, but evaluation of those small abnormalities creates a lot of worry, a lot of medical intervention. And so we are still, with lung cancer, left in this limbo where we don't have a good screening evaluation, which I think points out that your relationship with your primary care physician and maintaining good health and good health maintenance is really key.
And so with the same recommendations hold also for, say, an individual who might be deemed or felt to be high risk for developing lung cancer?
Those are the recommendations, because the studies were actually done in people who are identified as having risk. So to put that in perspective, the more recent studies were done looking at CT scanning in people who smoked. And so they all had the major risk factor, which was cigarette exposure. And in those individuals, depending on where the study was done in this country around the world, between 12 to over 50% of individuals on a single CT would have abnormalities. Mm. That's a lot of abnormalities. Mm-hmm. And of those, in excess of 98% were benign. And so the vast, vast majority of people who entered those studies who were found to have abnormalities, which were actually most of them, ended up undergoing sometimes very invasive evaluation for what was benign disease. And so the lesson from that is that CT scanning is very sensitive, but it is not a good screening tool. There is a big study going on right now in the U.S. that just is completing enrollment, and it's evaluating chest x-ray versus CT scan, again, as screening tools in people who have smoked. And the results of that National Lung Cancer Screening Trial, the NLST, should be out within the next year or two.
Oh, great. So it'll be interesting to see what those results are.
So there's definitely news coming down the road that we're very anxious to hear about.
Great. Well, you're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we're here in the studio this evening discussing lung cancer with Drs. Jonathan Puchalski and Lynn Tanui from the Yale School of Medicine.
It's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using 2 simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Ed Chu, and I'm here in the studio with Drs. Jonathan Puchalski and Lynn Tanui from the Yale School of Medicine, the Yale Cancer Center, discussing the role of detection, screening, and treatment of lung cancer. And before the break, we were talking about the role for early detection screening for lung cancer, and we were talking about, say, an individual who may have new symptoms or persistent symptoms. So, Jonathan, as you were saying, that individual will get a chest x-ray, and say, for instance, an abnormality was seen, say a mass was seen on the chest x-ray, what would be the next step taken for that individual?
So I think most of the time after that, patients will get additional tests, of course, and that's often a CAT scan of the chest, possibly other tests such as a PET scan, depending on the exact circumstance. But to further determine what that mass looks like on a more sensitive test or a higher resolution test per se, the CAT scan is often the next step.
And so CAT scan's done, visualizes, confirms that a mass is present. What next?
So usually at that point in time, the patient is going to be referred on for additional tests to figure out exactly what it is. Certainly not all generic masses are going to be cancer. There can be a host of things. And so the next step is often going to entail a test to specifically confirm what's been found on those radiographic imaging. And there are a lot of newer diagnostic modalities available that can really facilitate obtaining a specific diagnosis for these masses.
Now, you're head of the thoracic interventional program, and I know you've been actively involved in trying to develop some new technologies. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
So it's really an exciting time for these new technologies and for pulmonary and really all those who deal with lung cancer. There have been a lot of really revolutionary developments that have come to the forefront over the past several years that enable us to better diagnose these areas. And often that's done through something called a bronchoscopy. And a bronchoscopy is similar in some respects to what everybody's heard. So you have a colonoscopy, which looks at the colon. A bronchoscopy simply looks at the airways leading to the lungs. But rather than being limited just to the airways that we can see with a bronchoscope, these new technologies have really allowed us to look beyond the airway walls and further into the lungs themselves to find these masses that have been found on your CAT scan or your x-ray. So there are several technologies, including endobronchial ultrasound, something called electromagnetic navigation, and various other tests that will let us better diagnose the lesions by being able to find these lesions with the bronchoscope and direct our biopsies and other means of diagnosing the masses more accurately.
So at Yale, if someone were to come to you, so would anyone with the suspicion for lung cancer undergo these procedures?
Usually it's the next test, and it certainly depends on where in the lungs this is. So sometimes it's more appropriate to get a biopsy through a CAT scan, CT-guided biopsy. But with the evolution of these new technologies, we can actually diagnose things within the middle of the lung and even far out into the lung by being able to direct ourselves with this endobronchial ultrasound and electromagnetic navigation.
And I'm sure people who are listening there this evening might ask the question, you know, is there any potential danger in undergoing any of these procedures or any, you know, pain or discomfort that a patient might experience?
So it's very, not only is it exciting to have the technology, but these procedures are very low risk. The complication rates from these is extraordinarily low. And so compared to more invasive techniques that have been employed in the past, we're now able to not only obtain the diagnosis more accurately, but also in a very safe environment. So the complication rates are very low.
Great. And Lynn, once a diagnosis of lung cancer is made, well, I guess maybe the first question is lung cancer just one disease, or are there many different diseases or subtypes within lung cancer?
Well, we certainly understand a lot more about biology of lung cancer than we used to, although I think we still have a lot to learn. So lung cancer is divided into two big groups, small cell, which includes about 10 to 15%, and non-small cell, which is the rest. And in the non-small cell category in particular, since that really affects most patients, we are really beginning to be able to define differences in subgroups within that bigger category. And that is starting to have major implication for treatment, prognosis, outcomes, and so forth. So it's very important that the diagnostic piece is done very well, very thoroughly, so that gives the patient the most options and the best options for directed care. So the kinds of biopsies that Jonathan is able to do now really allows us to define histology, to define the pathology of the cancer without having to do a surgery. And I can't emphasize how much these minimally invasive bronchoscopic techniques have really changed our ability to do that sort of comprehensive evaluation, often without any surgery in our patients. So histology is very important. Because it increasingly affects the kind of treatments that are offered to the patient.
And I guess, you know, one of the real important aspects of approaching a patient with lung cancer is the multidisciplinary nature. And obviously, as director, co-director of the thoracic oncology program, it really is a multidisciplinary effort. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about that, Lynn. Yeah.
So we put a lot of effort into creating this multi-specialty group a number of years ago. We practice together, we see patients together, and we discuss them at tumor board together. And except for the very earliest stages of lung cancer, most patients will receive care from multiple specialties. So often the diagnostic part falls to Dr. Puchowski and myself and other pulmonologists. And then we stay involved through the care and because many of these patients do have underlying pulmonary disease that can become tricky during treatment and after. And most patients will require input from surgeons and radiation oncologists and medical oncologists. So it's very important that that care be very coordinated so that the patient isn't running back and forth. And when we put the program together, we envision this as like a bicycle wheel with the patient in the middle. And my concept 10 years ago was that watching my patients was like watching them run up and down the spokes of this wheel without a tire around it. Mm-hmm. And so it was the patient's responsibility to run to the oncologist and run to me and run to the surgeon. And at a time when they were emotionally and physically very stressed, that was a really awful thing for them. And so the thoracic oncology program, like all the multidisciplinary programs, the disease-centered programs at the Yale Cancer Center, puts the wheel on, puts the tire on, so that the patient can stay focused in the middle and we run around the patient rather than the other way around. And again, because the care for lung cancer, like the care of almost every cancer, is getting much more complicated now that there are different therapies, and now that we know that it's not one disease, I think these multidisciplinary groups are absolutely critical to streamlining the care, the best care for our patients and all patients with cancer.
But I guess one of the important aspects of your program is that you and the surgeons, the medical oncologists, the radiologists, pathologists are all seeing the patients together.
Absolutely.
In the same clinic at the same time.
Absolutely.
Which I think is really important.
And we have a nurse coordinator, and we have a social worker, and we interact with palliative care and, you know, all facets, really, of the medical center. And again, as the care has become better, it has become more complex. And so I can't imagine being a patient and trying to negotiate all of these different roads without a navigator. And we see ourselves, really, as providing that role. And we try to make this as little stress as possible, recognizing that anybody who has a diagnosis of cancer, that's a very difficult time for them.
Yep. And so diagnosis of lung cancer is made, John. And so what would be kind of, I guess, just in broad strokes, the different types of treatments that would be available for that patient?
So the general treatments would be either surgery for early stages, ranging up to chemotherapy, radiation therapy, combinations of those therapies, and then for advanced stages where even additional treatments are necessary, there can be bronchoscopic therapies that may help a patient breathe easier. So those include things like airway stents or laser surgery, or things that really improve the opening of airways so that the patients can breathe easier. So there's a whole range from complete cure to palliation of more severe symptoms.
And if an individual is, say, being considered for surgery, does one need to consider whether or not, you know, there is pre-existing lung disease and how the lung is functioning?
Sure, and we, as part of a comprehensive evaluation for that patient, certainly their lung function is evaluated. There are other tests, such as pulmonary function tests, that look at how well the patient can breathe, and various other factors that are accounted for prior to undergoing a surgery.
And so say a patient undergoes surgery, lung cancer is removed. What are the recommendations for follow-up of that patient?
We will follow that patient typically every 6 months for the first 3 to 5 years. Unfortunately, patients with lung cancer can relapse, and when that occurs, it most commonly occurs within the first 2 years after the cancer. So we tend to watch our patients very carefully during that period of time. And then beyond the 5 years, there are not good rules for that. But typically, our standard practice is we will do some imaging study, typically a chest X-ray, thereafter on an annual basis, because that patient is identified at a different risk. And unfortunately, anybody who's had one cancer is at higher risk to have a second. And in our patients with lung cancer, that second lung cancer, if it occurs, is most likely to be in the lung again. So that we've tried to create policies for ourselves, for our thoracic oncology program, even if national guidelines don't exist yet. And we're trying to contribute to the formation of those sorts of guidelines so that the care of these patients can be more standardized.
Right. And in the 30 seconds that we have left, John, are there any indications for, say, chemotherapy or radiation therapy after surgical operation has been performed?
Well, there can be, and it all depends on the exact case and the exact staging, and it's a little bit more difficult to get into those exact scenarios now. But there are lots of different possibilities in the treatment, and I think that's why it's important to be involved in a comprehensive program where there are people from multiple specialties who all have an eye on the patient.
Great. And maybe, Lynn, in the last few seconds, for anyone who's interested in contacting the thoracic oncology program, maybe you can tell us the number again.
So our main number, and you can reach any of us through this number or schedule a visit, is 203-688-LUNG, which is 5864. And our program coordinator will direct you to the right physician or give you an appointment to see us.
Great. Well, it's remarkable how quickly the time goes. It'll be great to have both of you come back to hear more about the thoracic oncology program and the thoracic interventional program.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'd like to thank our guests this evening, Drs. Jonathan Puchalski and Lynn Tanui, for joining me this evening. From the Yale Cancer Center, this is Ed Chu, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.